Welcome back again to BadQuaker.com podcast. Today is Monday, December 26th, 2011, and this is podcast number 71. Let's just make sure that this is out in the right out from the front on the get-go on this thing here. The Ron Paul campaign is suffering what might be considered entirely a predictable situation. The terrible racist newsletters from the olden days are coming back to haunt Ron Paul. And some people are making a big deal about it. Some people are saying it's not a big deal. Ron Paul walked out of an interview. Possibly by the time you hear this, there may be a new twist in the story, some new action that's taken place. So it may be that the words I'm saying to a large extent are no longer, you know, maybe what I'm saying is dated because I recorded this over the weekend rather than, you know, Monday morning. Like I, sometimes I record the podcast the actual morning of the podcast, sometimes the night before, sometimes in more than one segment. So, you know, it's hard to tell by Monday morning when this podcast is broadcast. What twist this story will have taken. It was pointed out by one person that it was kind of convenient that this whole thing sort of hit the fan right around a holiday, that really wasn't smart on the part of the left, that they should have waited until they would get better, a better audience for it all. But I don't think it happened because of actions on the part of the left. The left are generally smarter than that in how they use the media. I think this is happening directly due to libertarians themselves taking shots at Ron Paul and it becoming obvious to the media. And the media just, you know, they just respond to stimuli. They don't actually think. So, thank you. Well, so I'm actually getting into the body of the podcast rather than what I wanted to do. I want to give you an overview of how this podcast is, at least how I plan on it going. Who knows, you know, once I start talking, sometimes I just go in every direction, as you just saw. Anyway, so I want to give you an idea. What I want to touch on is accepting the consequences of your actions early rather than later. I want to talk about family secrets, because that's essentially what this whole racist newsletter thing is. It's sort of been this family secret that libertarians don't talk about, and we look the other way and we say, oh, well, it's a non-issue. We're just not going to talk about that. In the meantime, other libertarians are like, we need to talk about this. No, we're not talking about that. And so it's kind of a family secret. And so I wanted to talk about family secrets and, the dangers and, some of my thoughts on that. I want to talk about being a responsible libertarian and responsible libertarianism. Responsibility is one of the key foundational aspects of libertarianism. And so we as libertarians have to walk what we preach. We have to be that thing that we talk about. So I want to touch on that. I also wanted to talk about what the racist newsletters actually were, because it was actually a strategy. It was an idea, an attempt to accomplish a goal, and it was a bad idea, and it was a failed strategy. But I'll talk about that a little bit. I want to talk about crazed, wide-eyed, paranoid libertarians, because there are some, and we as a movement have a tendency to both embrace them and reject them. Hold their hand and punch them in the ear at the same time. So I wanted to talk about the crazed, wide-eyed, paranoid aspect of libertarianism and the ongoing image problem that this presents for us. And as an example of that, I want to talk about Rand Paul. And Rand Paul, when he was first running for the Senate in Kentucky, and then later, once he became a senator, once he actually won the election, this thing about his statements about the Civil Rights Act of 1964 popped up in his face a couple times. And then the media sort of, you know, their attention span is very similar to a gnat, so they dropped it and went on about their business. But I want to bring that into the light of the rest of this discussion. And I do want to touch on the Civil Rights Act of 1964 very briefly. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it. But this brings up a problem with Ron Paul. Just like with Rand Paul, the Civil Rights Act discussion presents a confusing level that that is difficult for people outside of our movement to grasp, because they're told from the right and the left these two wrong versions, and then we have our version of the situation, and neither the right or the left takes the time to even make an attempt to grasp it. So they just assume when a right-wing person hears a libertarian talk about civil rights, they just assume one of these two, the right or the left, and the left-wing person does the same thing. They don't bother to take a moment and find out what reality is from our point of view. And that's the problem with Ron Paul and immigration. Immigration is the same kind of a black eye for Ron Paul that Rand Paul faced with the Civil Rights Act. And Ron Paul's stance on immigration upsets a lot of libertarians, probably more so than you're going to see from any of the mainstream people. And I believe that's probably why, well, I'll get into that later. And then I want to talk about a return to first principles and how we can avoid all these things if we simply return to first principles. And I'm going to go into that a little bit on sort of a philosophical level. And then I have a section of this that I've entitled "The Great Conundrum Appears," and that's going to be our finale on this when we bring this all together. And if I can accomplish that, I'll be amazed, because usually I can't focus on a series of topics that well. So, and that's actually the reason that I'm laying it out like that in the beginning, is you know, perhaps that will discipline me to stay on my topic and not go off ranting about something else. Okay, so accepting the consequences of your actions early rather than later. Let me give the most personal example of that I possibly can, and that would be myself. When I was a young person, you know, late teens and so forth, I didn't have a lot of moral. Now, I should say this is not this is not my parents' fault, if you put it that way. They were very moral people. My parents, both heavy churchgoers, and they lived the life that they preached. They weren't hypocritical. They both set a good example. And so this is not a reflection of them. My siblings turned out relatively normal in their teen years. So what I'm about to tell you, I was an oddity. Let's go that direction. I was an oddity in my family. By the time I was midway into my teens, I was more than happy to steal, shoplift, do whatever I needed to do. I was never a good liar, so I figured out early on that I was not good at lying, so I was just better at telling the truth and taking the consequences, whatever that might be. And that's kind of where I learned other lessons as well, but that aside for the moment. So when I was a teenager, I had no problem stealing. I was very violent. I was not a good person. I snuck out. I, you know, went to bars when I was a young teenager, gambled. I was not a good person in the general way that we describe good people. By the time that I was late teens, I was dealing drugs, and I was, essentially enforcement for some people who ran loan sharking type businesses. I did collections. I was pretty rough person. I was big and strong, and so I knew how to intimidate people when I needed to. I knew how to scare a person when I needed to. And this led to all kinds of problems with, I think I mentioned on other podcasts that I've been shot a couple times, and it was a pretty rough life. And break-ins into businesses, armed robberies. It was a pretty rough life. And I, at the time, now we're talking, 16, 17, 18. At the time, I had I didn't think of the future at all because I figured I'd be dead in a few years anyway. And so I was just enjoying the ride. Now, at some point in time, I suppose you could say the catalyst was in meeting and falling in love with my wife. When she came into my life, all of a sudden I had a purpose, a reason. There, prior to that, it was just, hey, here's life, let's enjoy it, however long it lasts, great, and get as much out of it as possible. And stick your foot all the way to the floor and let's see how fast this thing will go. That was kind of my my philosophical point of view. But once I found my wife and, realized how much I loved her, and I wanted immediately to change everything about my life, and because I wanted a family, I wanted to have a good life with her, and I wanted to give to her everything that she needed and wanted and all her desires. And so this centered my focus. And I abandoned the previous life, and I began to seek philosophical and theological purposes as to, what was happening in my brain and everything. And so I changed dramatically. But that, what I mentioned a second ago, I learned early on, even when I was a very bad person, I learned early on that I was a horrible liar. So I figured out that embracing the truth and just walking headlong into the consequences in the long run was a more practical solution to pretty much anything that I was facing. And I learned not to fear the consequences of my actions because partly early on, I think it was just out of meanness and stubbornness that it was kind of a challenge. Like, yeah, I did that. So what? What are you going to do? But then with time and maturity, I realized that facing the consequences of your actions and being truthful about yourself and being truthful about what you've done and who you are and everything about you, in the long run, it is a more practical path than attempting to cover things up or attempting to lie about them or being anything other than completely open and honest. So not only is it may not be handy for the moment, the short term is, oftentimes, this is a general rule in life. If the short term, result of something is positive, probably the long term result is negative. And, therefore, very oftentimes it's the fact that if the short term, result of something is negative, there's oftentimes a long-term result that is positive. So, in other words, sitting down to eat an entire cake would be short-term very positive. When you're laying on the floor in a not cramping because you've overeaten, that would be a long-term negative. If you continue the process of eating a whole cake every day and you get to weigh 780 pounds and you're no longer able to stand up out of a chair and you have to wheel yourself around, well, that's a long-term negative. But certainly it's a short-term positive eating a cake. So that's a kind of a general thing that you see throughout life. If there's a short-term great amount of satisfaction, there's probably a long-term harm that's greater that outweighs that short-term satisfaction. So truth is like that. Facing the consequences of your actions and facing truth early on, the earlier you face the consequences, the less those consequences are. So as I grasp that fairly early, and as I abandon my previous violent life, the whole process of living outside of the law and all the things, violence and the theft and black markets. If you're a regular listener of this podcast, you know that I'm a supporter of black markets. I think black markets are good. But black markets carry with them certain dangers. And so now we're talking about the 1970s when I used to engage in, drug trafficking and so forth. It was well within my rights, but it was also, because it was a black market, there was a lot of violence, there was a lot of danger, there was a lot of, attempted murders and competition that a normal market doesn't face. But I embraced that stuff with glee back then. So when I abandoned all that, and when I no longer I made the decision not to have anything to do with the whole illegal drug lifestyle, and I decided that my wife and I would have what might be considered a normal life. We would raise our children without drugs, without the violence, without crime, and without all the stuff that comes with it. As I did that, and as we began that process, I made a commitment right from the beginning that I would not hide my background. I would walk with my head up, and I would admit to my wrongdoings. And if my children, as soon as my children were old enough to formulate a question, if they had a question for me about my past, I would not try to hide it. I would not try to gloss over it. In every way, I would be honest about my past, and that's both the good and the bad. And my thought was, sure, there may be some negative consequences to being that open and honest, but at the same point, I believe that the long-term effect of honesty will be good. So if I have to admit to something to my children that I did that was bad, the idea is that by being honest and by trying to make a moral lesson out of whatever mistakes that I'd made or whatever bad things that I had done, hopefully it will make my children better people so that they don't have to go through that stuff to learn. So that was my philosophy, and that was my philosophy from a very early age. So then about the time that, around the time of when my wife and I got married, and I should mention that we were both very young at the time, I had an ongoing clash with her family because, to be both specific and vague at the same time, there was one individual, there were several people in her family that I had a problem with, but there was one individual that was an elderly woman that... that I just hated her. I thought she was just a horrible, evil person. She was dominating everyone. It seemed to me that everyone bowed to her and everyone was afraid of her, and I couldn't figure out what the power was that she held over them. I thought at first it was, perhaps it was her wealth and she held sway because they all wanted her inheritance or something like that. But in later years, as I realized, she had no real wealth, and that wasn't the motive for bowing to this horrible, wretched witch. So for years, I couldn't figure out why these people bowed to her like this. And she was just a horrible monster of a person. But as the years progressed, I began to understand that there were family secrets within my wife's family that many of them only knew little pieces of, and none of them knew the whole picture. And when this horrible, wretched old witch finally died, then the truth of her life came out. A good time for dogs to be barking in the background. The hounds. If you're a regular listener to badquaker.com, animals interrupting the podcast are a regular part of this. So I always have to give that disclaimer. And oftentimes we have to pause the microphone and let the animals do their thing, and then I come back and try to pick back up the topic. So we'll see how that goes. Anyway, when this old witch died, all the secrets came out. And then I understood. I understood not only how she had come to be such a wretched, horrible human being that she was, why it was that she was so angry at everyone, and why she was so filled with hate, and why she sought to just harm people for the sheer enjoyment of doing that. I learned all these things, and I also learned why people tolerated it, because her husband was such a wonderful man, and her children were such wonderful human beings, that out of respect for her husband and her children, the rest of the family tolerated her hate and her nonsense, not because they were afraid of her, not because they wanted her wealth, not because they wanted to satisfy her, but they tolerated her because they loved her husband and her children. So once she was dead, then the whole thing came out, and I could see what all of this, where what its origin was, and I understood. Now, I could have never understood that from the experiences of my own family, because my own family didn't keep secrets. My own family, you know, we have all kinds of things in what other families might be considered skeletons in the closet. But we don't have any closet doors in my family. You know, we have an individual who deserted during the height of World War II. He deserted from the Navy multiple times, and my family never attempted to hide the story. We laugh about it and tell the story. Another individual who committed suicide in a particularly horrific fashion, and we never attempted to hide that. In our family, we didn't revel in the story, but we didn't attempt to hide it. There was a different situation, a long-going feud between my father's family and another family, and this was in Appalachia. So, first off, get out of your head the typical East Coast media lies about Appalachian people and feuds. That's not at all that whole thing is negative stereotyping and something they made up to entertain their ignorant masses in New York and Philadelphia and Boston and so forth. So just get that out of your head. But feuds in Appalachia were real, but not the cartoonish version like the East Coast media made money off of for 100 years. But my family had a feud with another family, and it culminated in one of the very important members of my family murdering a very important member of that other family. Now, in all the time that the feud went on, there was only that one real serious act of violence, and that ended the feud. So my family doesn't talk a lot about that because, you know, it was a pretty dramatic thing, but we don't hide it either. So, so I guess that's probably where I got some of my my love for the truth was from that. But that also provided a situation where I couldn't understand why my wife's family held all these secrets and hid it to such a degree. And then when I found out the story, it was like, well, here's this person who was a teenager, and evidently she married someone outside of the proper church structure that her family supported, and she ended up pregnant, and then her dad swooped in and snatched her out of this ungodly marriage and drug her off to Nevada or whatever and got a quickie divorce for her, and then she married a different guy, and then there was a second pregnancy, and then there was that guy got killed in World War II, and then there was a third guy that came along, and it just there were all these layers of stuff that family saw as shame and saw as, you know, negative and had to keep secret and had to keep it all held down. And this poor girl who had to suffer through this stupidity of her family, of humiliating her and forcing her into a divorce and all the things that she had to tolerate, she grew up to be that wretched old witch. And then you see, now you understand, or this was my position, now I understand why she was as hateful as she was. And yet to the people who were the very closest to her, she was extremely loving. It's just, if you weren't right inside that tiny little circle, she was just a wretched human being. So, using this as an example, we have within the libertarian movement, we have these dirty little secrets in our past. And, the longer that we hide them and refuse to talk about them or whisper about them in the background or say that they're not important, they're not going to go away. They're just not going to go away. Things like this don't go away. They fester, and eventually, it starts to ooze. And if you don't do something about the infection, if you don't lance that thing open and get rid of the infection and directly deal with it, it's just going to keep getting worse and worse. And this is the situation with these racist newsletters. I don't blame Ron Paul at all. I have, let me just be clear, let me just explain the racist newsletters to the extent that I can or that I will. Ron Paul had an arrangement with several other libertarian people, and the point was to generate revenue. There was two points, as I understand it. There was one was to generate revenue for the overall cause of liberty, and the other was to attempt to bring in some of the more fringe elements of the liberty oriented people. Now, I should mention at this point that there are liberty-oriented people that are extremely right-wing, and there are liberty-oriented people that are extremely left-wing. There are liberty-oriented people who are very inconsistent about their desire and understanding of liberty. So knowing this, there was a specific strategy to try to bring in some of these fringe elements into the mainstream of libertarian view. Now, it could be argued that that was a serious mistake. It could be argued that it was not a serious mistake. That's not my point. My point is just to give somewhat of a history of this situation. There existed this fringe element. There always has existed and there always will exist a fringe element of the liberty movement, which is on the extreme right. These people often are racists. These people are often a little on the wide-eyed paranoia end. Some of them tend towards some of the more foil hat type activities. Some of them, are Bigfoot hunters. Some of them are militia types. Some of these people on the fringe elements of the liberty movement are really not considered sane by a lot of the mainstream public in North America. For whatever reason, and I'm not here to debate the positive or negative aspects of this decision, but for whatever reason, certain elements of the liberty movement decided that it would be a good idea to reach out to those people and to try to harvest some of the money that they sat on to be used to further the cause of liberty. Again, I'm not questioning if it was a good strategy or a bad strategy. I'm just explaining the strategy. And I should mention that in all likelihood, Ron Paul had no knowledge and no involvement of any of that strategy. At least as far as I can tell, he had no knowledge of it and was not a part of it. Now, certain elements of the liberty movement who designed that plan, that strategy, some of them are alive and some of them are not alive. Now, Ron Paul probably could point out He may be telling the truth when he says he doesn't know who wrote those racist newsletters that had his name on them. He probably is telling the truth, but you know, it's kind of like, what can I compare it to? If there's only two people in my house, myself and one other person, and if I don't go out and check the mail, and yet the mail appears on my kitchen table, it's not hard for me to deduce from the evidence at hand who checked the mail, because I know it wasn't me and there's only one other person in the house. So that kind of narrows down. So can I say I know who checked the mail? Well, not really, because, you know, the mailman could have delivered my mail to a different address, and that person may have been kind enough to bring the mail and open the door, you know, or the other person in my house. You know, there's all kinds of circumstances that are possible. So I can deduce in this scenario, I can deduce who probably checked the mail, but I can't say for a fact who checked the mail unless I ask the other person, oh, I see there's mail on the table. Did you check the mail? Well, that would be a silly thing to ask. Like, who else checked? Who could have? Who else? Of course I checked the mail. All right, but if I don't ask, then I can't say that I absolutely know. So I think maybe that's the game Ron Paul is playing. I think Ron Paul knows who checked the mail in a sense that, I mean, who could it be? Who else could it be? And yet, at the same time, it's not Ron Paul's position to out anyone. So this is a level of honor that Ron Paul is stuck with. I believe, and I could be shown to be wrong on this at some point, but I believe Ron Paul has a level of honor which says, you know, if this costs me my bid to the presidency, then so be it, but I'm not going to rat out anybody. If somebody wants to admit to these newsletters, then they could admit to it, but I'm not going to rat them out. Now, I believe Ron Paul has a level of honor that he will stick with that. Time will tell on that, and we'll see. On the other hand, there is someone out there who is responsible for these newsletters, and if they had the level of honor that Ron Paul has, they would come forward and admit to their involvement in the newsletters. I find that highly unlikely. However, I'm just tossing that out. I'm not pointing my finger at anyone but that person or persons, because I think there are two living people who were involved, and I think that there was probably one or two, possibly three people who were involved who are no longer living. And it could be that the ones living don't want to rat out the ones that are past. I would understand that, but it boils down to, as far as I know, I think it's pretty close to being a fact as to the one or two, possibly three people who are alive that were involved and could come forward and say, yes, this was us, Ron Paul knew nothing about it, but I don't think they will. Okay. Now that goes back to accepting the consequences of your actions early rather than later. Had the people involved come out right away, back years ago, and said, you know what, I wrote this, or I strategized with another person, we worked together on this, and it was a mistake. We were trying to reach out to this fringe group, and partially we wanted to harvest some of their wealth, and unfortunately this came back to bite us. If those people involved had done this years ago, then there would be no ammunition for Ron Paul to attack Ron Paul with today. Okay, so the earlier you face something like this, the easier it is to admit your fault, and the less repercussions there are. The longer you let it fester, the worse it's going to get. So, in other words, today would be a better time to admit to this than tomorrow, and tomorrow would be a better time than next year. And day after tomorrow would be a better time to admit to this than when Ron Paul is running up against Obama and it really hits the mainstream media. Tomorrow or the next day or, you know, this week or this month or this year would be better than then. But it would have been better if it was already out and done with. That way Ron Paul wouldn't have to deal with this at this point in time. So it was a failed strategy. There are the crazed, wide-eyed, paranoid libertarians. They are part of us. And not only that, I will defend the fact that they are out there. I will defend their wide-eyed paranoia. They have a right to be wide-eyed and paranoid. There's a lot of scary things in the world, and the state has put a lot of effort into causing us to be afraid of each other. So there are some libertarians that are out there, and there are right-wing elements that are very liberty-oriented who are horrible racists. I don't like these people. I have put quite a bit of... I've taken personal heat because I pointed racists out that were, you know, attempting to paint themselves as libertarians using the brush of racist hate. I have pointed these people out and I've taken heat for it. But the, you know, on the other hand, if someone is a racist, I may be disgusted by them. I may dislike them to a very high degree. I may not tolerate having them in my presence, but I will still defend their right to be an angry, nasty, stupid racist. They have a right to be a stupid racist. They have that right. They can be a racist. As long as they're not aggressing on somebody else, then they can be racist all they want. Now that's just the fact. If you don't like the fact that they're racist, too bad on you. I don't like the fact that you don't like them. But I'm not going to take any actions. And the difference is between what somebody thinks and what actions take place. You see, somebody can think crimes all day, but if they don't commit the crime, they haven't committed the crime. And that's the thing with a person who is a racist. If they hold these things in their heart, if they hold this hate in their heart, they can hold that hate in their heart their whole life. And if they don't act on it, then they haven't acted on it. If they act on it, it's not what's in their heart that's bad, it's the action. So deal with the action. And if they haven't actually done anything, if they haven't aggressed on another human being, then they have not done anything wrong. I'm not talking about thoughts. I'm not talking about beliefs. I'm talking about the difference between thoughts and beliefs and actions. And this is where the libertarian is completely different from those on the right and those on the left. Those on the right and those on the left can't handle the thought that there are people out there who might do something that you don't approve of. I'm not talking about an act of aggression on another human being. I'm talking about people on the right and people on the left who are so wrapped up in their minds that they think everybody has to be like them. People on the left think that everybody has to accept all these different all the different races, all the different social groups, all the different, you know, and people on the right tend to not want to do that. And this, the fact that they won't tolerate anybody else, you know, the left always preaches tolerance, you know, but in reality, the left is entirely not tolerant. Because the only way they're tolerant is if you're in agreement with them. Well, that's not tolerant. So the libertarian position is that if no one is acting, if there's no act of aggression, then it doesn't matter what they believe, and it doesn't matter what they think, and it doesn't even matter what they say. It only matters when they act. So if there are racists, it's none of your business as long as they don't act. And if they act, and that act is an act of aggression, then it's the act of aggression, not their belief, not their hate, not their being a racist. It's not that they're a racist. It's that they used aggression. So that's why someone in the libertarian movement can allow someone who is an ugly, hate-filled racist to be a part of us. Because we're tolerant, unlike the left and the right. And people on the right, you know, they get all bent out of shape over, you know, different topics, but the same way. Let's use this for an example. There are, I beat these people up pretty regularly. Let's use the the Venus Project people. They're supposedly anarchists, and yet the utopia that they dream of is entirely a socialist utopia. And so there are people that are very upset about that. Well, you know, oh, no, we can't have socialism this bad. Well, socialism will fail. Socialism is always the least effective or the least efficient form of any type of a government. But if a group of people get together and they agree to be socialist among themselves and they're not using aggression on anyone else, then no one has the right to try to stop them from being socialists. So, in other words, I'll fight for the socialist to be a socialist as quick as I'll fight for the free market person to be a free market person, because no one has the right to aggress upon someone else because of their beliefs, no matter how stupid their beliefs are. You see? All right, so at this point in time, it's apparent that I'm not going to get through all my points that I wanted to touch. So let me see if I can speed this up a little. Rand Paul, when he, okay, so let me just touch back on the other thing. We are going to have an ongoing image problems, an ongoing image problem. Libertarians are always going to have an image problem because people on the right and people on the left are not going to understand. They're not going to understand that we can tolerate a racist being in front of us, or we can tolerate someone using drugs over there, or we can tolerate that there are socialists wanting to live in a commune. We can tolerate these things as long as there's no aggression involved. And the right and the left will never understand that. So we're going to have an image problem. What we have to do is face what the real issue is, not that that person is a racist, not that that person is a communist, not that that person over there uses, you know, some drug or whatever. That's not the problem. The problem always comes down to first principles. Is there aggression involved? If there's not aggression involved, then it's none of your business what they're doing or what they're thinking or what they're saying or what they're believing. It doesn't matter if they're filled with hate as long as they don't aggress. So that's what we have to bring it back to. Now, let me touch on Rand Paul and the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Someone questioned Rand Paul around the time he was running for office as senator. And he just tossed out the statement, well, he wouldn't have supported the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Now, this is akin to someone saying, well, I'm okay with there being racist libertarians. In the mind of the left and the right, when they hear things like this, they immediately leap to a false conclusion. So if you say, I don't support the Civil Rights Act, when it goes into their ear, what it comes into their brain as is, I'm a racist. That's what they hear. Okay, so when the person on the right hears you say, I don't support the Civil Rights Act, what they think is, oh, he's a racist just like me. And when it's a person on the left hearing the same statement, you say, I don't support the Civil Rights Act, and what they hear is, you're a racist. Okay, no, we are not. What we're just doing is handing our enemy weapons. We're just blindly handing them a club to beat us with when we do things like this. This is the exact same situation when we have Ron Paul talking about how he would secure the borders. Now, as soon as he says that, some people in the liberty movement really get upset, because what Ron Paul says about securing the borders is entirely inconsistent with libertarian views. So when he says that, he's, you know, I don't know what's actually in his mind. I assume he's telling the truth, that he thinks that's a good idea. But when people in the right wing hear that, they think, yeah, he's going to go, you know, stop them ugly, dirty little brown people from coming across our southern border, because they're racist. They're like that. And when people on the left hear this, they think, oh, Ron Paul is a racist. See? That's what they think, because their mind only goes in that direction. And of course, I don't think Ron Paul is the slightest bit racist. I don't think he is. But when, just like with Rand Paul, what he said about the Civil Rights Act, when these people on the right and left hear Ron Paul talk, they leap to this conclusion. And the real thing is that we have to return to first principles with this. Now, I said this before. Let me explain what first principles are. First principles, a first principle is a basic foundational proposition or assumption that can't, that cannot be deduced from any other proposition or assumption. What I mean by that is like, okay, we'll take a statement. This is a good Meesian statement here. People act. That's a first principle. People act. How do I prove that? You just heard me prove it because I said people act, and me saying people act was an action. And you listening to me saying people act was an action. So we know people act because I'm here and I said people act. So I don't need to prove that people act. It's a first principle. Okay, so when you start to understand things like this, you start to understand how to take your mind back to the foundational principles like that, then you start to ask yourself something like, okay, can two wrongs make a right? Is it possible for two wrongs to make a right? And no, two wrongs cannot make a right. And why is that? Well, we start to return to first principles, and we check this concept with first principles, and we come to the conclusion by only looking at the first principles and deducing what we can deduce from first principles, we learn that two wrongs can never make a right. Okay, if two wrongs can't make a right, can government aggression fix what was caused by government aggression? Can the government use aggression to fix what it broke by using government aggression? That's the same question formulated in a different way. Can two wrongs make a right? Two wrongs can never make a right. The government can never fix using aggression. The government can never fix what the government broke by using aggression. If I have a piggy bank and a hammer, and I smash the piggy bank with the hammer, can I further hit the piggy bank with the hammer and expect the piggy bank to return to its state prior to my first strike? No. No amount of hitting the piggy bank will ever return it to its first condition. The government, let's go back to first principles. When a government is based on the activities of the state, and I've talked about this before, the difference between government and state, go over to badquaker.com and click on the links to definitions, and you can go through all that. When a government is controlled by the state, that means the very fact that a government is controlled by the state means that all of its actions are based on aggression, theft, and lies. When a government is controlled by the state, all of its actions are theft, aggression, and lies. Now, it's often been said that when your only tool is a hammer, every problem looks like a nail. Now, there are two ways that a government can exist. A government can exist through voluntary measures, or a government can exist through the state. The state, by its very nature, is based on aggression, theft, and violence. Aggression, theft, and lies. So when the government is based on the state, the only tools that the government has, that's dog noises, by the way, if you hear that. Okay, so we had another dog-related delay there. See if I can pick this back up again. Okay, so we have two forms of government. A government that can be based on voluntarism, or a government that's based on the state. We currently function under a government that's based on the state. All governments that are based on the state are based, their only actions can be aggression, theft, and lies. So, What about the Civil Rights Act of 1964? The Civil Rights Act of 1964 was the government using its only tools in its box to try to fix what it already broke, using those same tools in the box. So what is the Civil Rights Act of 1964? Is it something that we want to support? Well, can you fix the piggy bank by hitting it more times with the hammer? Will that fix the piggy bank? Government aggression caused the civil rights problem to begin with. More government action won't solve it. This is going back to first principles and explaining the situation rather than just saying, oh no, I wouldn't have voted for that. No, they don't understand that when you say that. And this is the situation with Ron Paul and the immigration issue. Government aggression caused the problem with the border with the Mexican border. Government aggression perpetuates the problem. The solution is not more government aggression. Now, the more you think about this, the more you start to realize how dramatically wrong Ron Paul is on immigration. On the other hand, his entire voting base from where he's at in Texas probably entirely supports that position. But rather than going back to first principles and saying the government can't fix this problem it created by using more aggression, that's not the solution to the problem. Finding out why we have an immigration problem, then undoing what the government did, that's how you fix the immigration problem. Not by just running in with another hammer. You'll probably hear more dog noises again. So now this brings up the great conundrum. When we think of Rand Paul and the Civil Rights Act, consider this question. If the Civil Rights Act of 1964 is bad because government can't use aggression to fix what it caused by using aggression, Rand, why are you running for office? Let's look at it different. If two wrongs can't make a right, how can you want to use government aggression to solve government aggression? Ron, if two wrongs can't make a right, why do you want to use the office of the presidency to solve the aggression that the office of the presidency committed, when the only power of the office of the presidency, power by its very definition, is what? Power. How can you want to hold the office of the presidency when the only thing the president can do is aggression? You have two choices as president. You can act in an aggressive fashion, because that's the only power the president has, or you can not act. To not act is just staring at the broken piggy bank. To act is to hit it again with another hammer. Neither of these is the solution. The solution is not to have a government based on the state. Becoming president doesn't solve that problem. Becoming senator doesn't solve that problem. Just saying we'll just fog the border with all of our military doesn't solve the problem of immigration. Saying the Civil Rights Act of 1964 is bad does not solve the civil rights problem that in reality has existed and does exist. Again, the concept of using the government to fix the government, that's the problem. Having a government that's based on a state rather than having a government that's based on voluntarism. So, what is the solution? The solution is to withdraw from the state. Stop believing that it exists. Realize that the state is an excuse for violent people to take violent actions. And that the actions of people are not the actions of the state, they're the actions of people. And the state only exists because we believe it exists. And when we stop believing the state exists, the state will cease to exist. People didn't stop believing in Zeus because the priest of Zeus went around convincing people to believe in Zeus, therefore you can't believe in Zeus. How did we stop believing in Zeus? We just stopped believing in Zeus. And that's how we deal with the state. That's how we deal with the aggression of the state. Not by going in and getting involved and becoming a part of the state and acting on behalf of the state, but by realizing that there is no state. And when people in government act under the assumption there is a state, they're only either acting using aggression, theft, or lies. And those things will never fix the aggression, theft, and lies that the state has caused. So as much as I like Rand Paul and Ron Paul, and as much as I would like to support all the people who are putting in all this work to try to get Ron Paul elected, this is the problem. You can't fix what's broken by striking it more with the very item that broke it. I hope that people understand where I'm coming from with this. I'm not against Ron Paul, but Ron Paul is just a man, and he can't fix the state. And unless he and all his supporters realize what the state is, you have no chance of fixing this. You have to get back to first principles. You have to ask yourself those basic questions. Get it back to the start. Get it back to what we know. What are facts? What is reality? And the reality is, two wrongs cannot make a right. People act. The state does not exist. There is no state. There is only the acts of people. And when people act aggressively, it's wrong. Thanks, folks, for listening to BadQuaker.com. As always, go to BadQuaker.com for more on the Zero Aggression Principle, property rights, and liberty. Thanks a lot, folks.